that does help people that make relatively small donations participate. And how is it working? How long have we had it? What's what? Whatever facts you think we should know, Chris. Appreciate your coming.
Madam Chair, members of the task force, thanks for having me here. I have about a dozen slides. It'll take about 15 minutes or so, I think, to go through, so not too long. And it's basically a snapshot of what we see from the tax returns. The credit has been in place since 1969. And I have, generally speaking, some time series data going back to 1990, and then a lot of slides focusing on 2010. There were some slides that had already been created, so I kind of built some information around that to give you just at least a flavor of the information on the from the tax returns.
I'm going to try to not be in the way of people looking at slides.
And I think it sounds like everybody's familiar with this credit, but just so that we're all on the same page, Oregon has the credit for political contributions. It is a non-refundable credit of up to $50 per filer. And it is allowed for contributions made to a major or minor political party, any candidate for federal, state, or local office, or to a political action committee. It is $50 per filer, so joint returns, they can claim up to a $100 credit. And for those not familiar with tax credits, it is non-refundable. So most of our credits are non-refundable. We have a few that are refundable. Basically, credits can be used to drive down a taxpayer's liability to zero. And if they still have some additional credits, a non-refundable credit just means they lose the value of that credit. In contrast, a refundable credit means a taxpayer can get a refund beyond their liability. But this credit is non-refundable. The $50 is not indexed to inflation, so that's fixed. The most recent change to it was made in 2013. The legislature means-tested the tax credit. Since 2011, the legislature has been going through a tax credit review process where every session, roughly one-third of the state's tax credits are up for review. And the policy committees and then the revenue committees and then the joint tax credit committee review those tax credits and decide which ones get extended or allowed to sunset or modified in one way or another. And in 2013, this was one of about 20 tax credits that were reviewed, and it was means tested. So beginning with tax year 2014, the credit is limited to single filers with income under $100,000 and joint filers with income under $200,000. So jumping right into it, here is a graph that shows the tax credit amount claimed since 1990. And you can see that it does vary with the political process. Generally speaking, the even years are higher than the odd years, and then presidential campaigns tend to be higher than the non-presidential even years. And that's what those green bars are. The smooth line is just a two-year moving average. It helps pull out the trend that we've seen over time for the claim in the tax credit.
What kind of money are we looking at? I can't read the numbers.
The top number is $9 million. So in the 90s, about $4 million a year was claimed on average. And then going from 1998 to about 2008, there was an increase in the tax credit up to about $7 million a year, just roughly speaking. And it peaked in 2008 at just over $8 million being claimed. So we did have the level now. So basically in the 90s, we were at $4 million. We had an increase for about 10 years, and it's kind of leveled off and showing signs of declining here in recent years. And mainly that comes from 2012, the presidential election. This credit was used less than in 2008. So 2008 was the peak. One thing that to note on the graph as 2014 and that bar being red is part of the reason that's lower is the policy change and the means testing in 2013. So that's kind of a false trend, if you will. I took a quick look at the returns, and if it had not been means tested, the amount that would have been claimed, I think, would have been around $6.5 million. So it still would have been roughly level or maybe slightly down from 2010. So recent data suggests that we're kind of at a new plateau, that it did increase, but we seem to have leveled off there.
Chris and Aaron, I'm assuming your text, your slides are available, that Aaron will have them, and we'll put them on our website.
So this slide is just the number of claimants. And because of the structure of the tax credit, basically $50 per person, any trends in the dollars claimed will be almost identical to the number of claimants. But I often get these questions, so I just wanted to show the same information for the number of claimants. And so it shows the same trend where, and now I can't even see the numbers. So that in the early 1990s, we had about 60,000 claimants, and that has increased to recently. We're in about the 100,000 claimants a year. And these are just really ballpark averages to go through the political cycle. And again, the same note about 2014. The reason in the drop there is because of the policy change. And looking at those, I think we would have had maybe another 10,000 claimants. 7,000 to 10,000 claimants if it had not been means tested. So the next couple of slides, I try to tease out the political cycles here and break down, rather than annual data, I break it down according to election cycles. So the graph on the left, both of these are for the even years. The graph on the left are the presidential elections. So we see kind of a smooth trend for 92, 96, and 2000, and then a strong increase in 2004 and 2008, and then it fell in 2012. So we'll be watching it and see what happens this year with this political cycle. And then in the non-presidential even years, it's roughly the same trend, except there was an exception in 1994. And I don't know exactly why, if that was driven by the movement at the national level with what happened in Congress, the change in the House there, or if it was a gubernatorial election, or what the ballot measures were at the time. I believe 94 was the year that ballot measure 9 was on, which is directly related to the issue. So I don't know if that has a direct tie to perhaps increased contributions at the time. But that's just another way to look at, to try and think about the political cycle. This one is the odd years, and this might give a better sense of the overall general trend in the use of the tax credit because these are non-election years. And again, it just emphasizes that other trend where we had a certain level in the 1990s, it grew throughout the odd years, and we seem to have plateaued in recent years. I don't know if people can make this out. But this is, we also have information from tax returns on the age of the tax filers. So for joint filers, we refer to this as the age of the primary filer. So for joint returns, it's the first name on the return. And what we see when we're looking at the age, and this is 2010, this is a graph from the Department of Revenue. And it shows that, roughly speaking, with age, the older taxpayers get, the more likely they are to contribute. So the first bar here are people basically under the age of 30, and about 1.5% of those filers will contribute or take advantage of the tax credit. When we get into 30-somethings, that more than doubles to just under 4%, and then increases through 40-somethings and 50-somethings, and tops out at about 9% of taxpayers will claim the credit. And I'll be looking at this for other years to see how that changes, but I don't really expect a priori that it'll change from year to year. Another question that comes up is just overall usage rate. And this graph takes the total number of claimants divided by the number of filers. So in aggregate, the share of the filers that are claiming the credit. And in the 90s, that percentage was around 4%. It did decline in the second half of the 90s, and then it shows that same trend that we saw before, increasing from 98 to 2008 and kind of leveling off, or perhaps a slight indication that the usage is declining in recent years. And this chart shows tax credit usage by county. And so we have the county usage rates range from about 2.5% in Malheur County to about 9% in Benton County. And the statewide average usage is about 6%. And so a third of the top third of the tax credits there are the dark blue bars. And as I said, Benton County has the highest usage. Polk County has the second most highest use at about 7.5%. And then we get to some of the Portland area counties. And the eastern county with the highest usage there is Union County at just about 6.5%. And for those who are map-oriented, here is the map. So there's the nice visual there. And you can see that usage is highest, roughly speaking, along the valley, and then the one county in the south coast, and then roughly the north coast and middle and southern Oregon are kind of in the middle of the pack. And then, roughly speaking, eastern Oregon is the least likely to claim the tax credit. Now, this pie chart gets at usage by income group. And the starting point here is to take all of the filers from the lowest income to the highest income and to divide them into quintiles, basically five even groups. And each 20% of filers is about 316,000 filers. So let's see. So this top group here, this top 20%, these are the top 20% of income filers in 2010. So the wealthiest or the richest 316,000 filers in 2010, and they accounted for, I don't think it showed up on here, it's about 56 or 57% of the claimants. And then the next 316,000, the next 20% wealthiest claimed about 36%. And then getting all the way down to this slice here, which are the lowest income, the 20% at the bottom of the income, they accounted for 22% of the usage of the tax credit. And just for some context, those dollar amounts, the top 20%, that demarcation is $77,000 of income. So those filers with at least $77,000 of income, that's 20% of filers, and about 56% of the claimants for this tax credit. Now, again, this is before it was means tested, and I have a table that gets at that piece. And on the other end, at the bottom 20% are filers with less than $12,000 of income.
And if you didn't qualify, I mean, if you couldn't take advantage of it because you didn't owe enough in taxes, then you wouldn't be included in these numbers, is that right?
These numbers are if they claimed them.
They claimed it.
And so if a taxpayer knew that they wouldn't be able to use it, they probably wouldn't claim
right.
it. Some, generally speaking, the higher income folks, they'll claim it. They may not be able to use it all.
Mm-hmm.
And then the lower income folks are the ones.
Because they might not owe enough in taxes.
Yes, they might not owe enough in taxes. So these people might be eligible to claim it, and they might be making contributions, but they know they're not going to have the liability.
Right.
Having said that, with the refundable credits, and not to get off topic, but if you have a low-income person who can claim the EIC, they can still claim the political action credit, political contributions credit. They'll get that, and then they'll get a larger refundable portion of the EIC.
Mm.
I'm not sure how well that's understood by taxpayers. This part breaks out the top 20%. So we have the top 1% claiming about 5% of the credit, and then the next 4%, another 15%, and then rounding out the top 20, I think that's about 5%. And again, just to put dollar numbers on here, the top 1% in 2010 are filers with at least $305,000 of income. And then the top 5%, which would be the sum of these two pieces, would be filers with $146,000 of income. So this does show that across the income spectrum where most of the claimants are. Now here is a table also by income, and it breaks out two categories of filers. We have single filers and joint filers. And across the board for the income spectrum, joint filers are more likely to claim the tax credit than single filers, ranging from about 5% down here to for joint filers, close to 30% of filers with at least $500,000 of income claim the credit. And for the single filers, I believe that's maybe 26% or so of filers of that income level claim the credit. One note, when I, for those who may or may not be familiar with these types of graphs, this rapid increase here, not all of these income categories are the same size. So it's not like we get to here and then we get up to $100,000 of income and then participation starts to skyrocket. To get a better picture of that, I would need a much wider graph to show equal increments. So in all likelihood, if I had this wide enough, so it would be almost the length of the room, this trend would probably be more smooth all the way throughout. That's just one of the challenges of trying to condense information on a graph. And here is the impact of the means testing. It's just a table comparing 2010 and 2014. 2014 is the 1 year that we have for the means testing. And I'm comparing it to 2010 here because that's the most recent similar year with respect to the election cycle. And we can see at the top end here in 2010, we had about 5,000 filers with at least $250,000 of income. And those taxpayers are no longer allowed to claim the tax credit. And for the $100,000 to $250,000 income group, now these are single and joint filers, so about 3,000 to 5,000 or 6,000 people would no longer be allowed to claim the tax credit. And there wouldn't be any single filers in this group because their income is above $100,000. So all of these filers right here are joint filers. And over here, you can actually see the average credit. And for the most part, it's a mix. It's going to be somewhere between $50 and $100 because it's a mix of the single filers and joint filers. And at the bottom end, you even have some folks not even claiming the full $50 or $100. And the last chart I have gets at this notion of frequency of claimants. Are these taxpayers the same people year after year, or are they coming in and out of claiming the tax credit? And this can be highly dependent on the time period chosen, but this chart, again, taken from the Department of Revenues for tax years 2006 through 2010, and 15% of the filers claim the tax credit in each of these 5 years. So these are your regulars. And then going down to those claiming only once during those 5 years, about 40% of the claimants during this time period only claimed it in 1 year. Chances are that was 2008. That was the peak year of claiming the tax credit. And so the last slide I have here is the research that exists on the tax credit. I'm just beginning to get versed in what's out there about state level tax credits and the impact of the credits. Generally, the purpose seems to be to get people involved into the political process. So the question is really whether or not the tax credit gets people into participating in the process, or if it's just going to people who are going to make contributions anyway, which is a tough question to get at. So a couple of the entities that I've found have done some research, USPRG, American Enterprise Institute, and the Campaign Fine Institute. And looking ahead to the Oregon process, as I mentioned before, we do have this tax credit review process. And in 2013, along with the modifications to this tax credit, the means testing, the sunset was extended to January 1, 2020. And the Legislative Revenue Office is now required to produce a report on the tax credits that are due for sunset every legislative session. So I'm expecting in 2019, that report will include a review of this tax credit and will incorporate the research that exists on the effects of the tax credit, both in Oregon and elsewhere. Kind of whatever, it's a general literature review on everything we know about this, and there might be some information that comes out of this task force that will feed into the report. And then the 2019 legislature will review this, or at least I expect, and things can change a lot, whatever happens in 2017 or 2018. And the 19 legislature will have this before them to decide if they want to extend the tax credit or modify it further. And that can be anything. Some of the usual ideas are to make the credit refundable so that taxpayers at the lower income can take full advantage of the tax credit, possibly modifying it for inflation so that the $50 or $100 changes with inflation. It could be increased, and there can be any number of other ideas that groups like this might come up with on ways to modify that policy to better achieve the purpose, or even better clarity around what the purpose is. That's been one of the biggest challenges with the tax credit review process, is having a clear statement of what a tax credit is supposed to do. That's really the first step in evaluating a tax credit. There needs to be some broad consensus about what it's supposed to do. So. And that's really all I had. That's just kind of a snapshot from tax return information.
Can I ask you one quick question? Do you have any numbers on the percentage of the tax credits that are taken by donations to candidates versus PACs versus political parties? Do you have any breakout of that?
We don't have that information. It's a common question. And the way I try to describe it is that information on a tax return is limited to information necessary to determine tax liability. And so because from a policy perspective, the contribution to a PAC or any political party or any candidate, it's all valued the same. That information is irrelevant to determining the tax returns, the tax liability. So on the one hand, the tax returns are a great source of a lot of good information, but they do have their limits. And so to get at that kind of information, we have to rely on other secondary information. There might be somebody out there who has been able to take tax returns and link that. So conceptually, at some level, it's possible to link tax returns to contribution. But that is fraught with a number of challenges and a lot of people who specifically don't want to do that for a lot of good reasons. So I don't know if anybody's tried to do that. And access to tax return information is very limited. The legislature has been very clear and wants to keep the secrecy around tax returns very private. Oregon has been pretty strict about that.
Yeah, a couple questions, Chris. One is I want to make sure I understand that the tax credit can be claimed whether you do the long form or the short form. Is that correct?
Correct. And actually, Oregon no longer has a short form.
Okay. Then secondly, I'm just curious, as an economist, do you see any patterns in use of the tax credit that strike you as surprising? Or is it all, does it strike you as pretty predictable how it gets used?
The political cycle, obviously. I mean, that one of the things that jumped out at me on this, because I hadn't really looked at it in a while, is the increase from roughly 98 to 08. I'm not sure exactly if that was driven by particular circumstances of issues that were going on in the U.S. over that time period. And we'll be watching it closely now to see if it levels off. If there's just been a level increase from the 90s to now about participation in the process, or if it's people just being aware of the tax credit and, like, realizing, well, I'm making these contributions anyway, so I'm going to claim the credit. And what we can do to tease out those two pieces, how much is actually new participation in the process and how much is what economists might refer to as a deadweight loss in terms of people who are going to make these contributions anyway and now they're getting the tax credit. I know we'll be getting questions, those kinds of questions, during the 19th session.
It'll be interesting to see how people use it this year.
Yes.
2016 returns.
And that's one of the issues. So we can control for election cycles. So if you just say you want to look at presidential elections, every election from one to the next, and I don't think I'm saying anything people aren't already know, the issues can be so unique to that time period that teasing out those effects can be a challenge to get at long-term trends. But the tax credit has been in place since 1969. I'm not sure how far back I can go to get information. I'll be exploring that to see what we get. The longer time horizon we get, the better chance we have of teasing out those long-term trends.
Thanks.
Do you have any estimate for how many people could benefit from claiming the credit but don't, probably because they don't know it's there?
I don't right now. That's kind of on my to-do list for the report that we have to now we won't be working on that report until 2018. We have a different group of tax credits right now. But that would be an issue on how well we can come at get at such estimate. There's information out there about the small donors and somehow linking an estimate there. We might be able to come up with an estimate of how many people should be claiming the credit, and then I might be able to get at least an initial estimate of how many such people might be.
Is that your question, Kyle? People who are actually giving a contribution and could have
yes.
used the tax
could have benefited from it.
Because he does know out of the filers who probably income-wise at this point would be eligible the proportion that actually use it. I see.
And that yeah. poses some interesting insight into the actual incentive nature of the tax credit. And to the extent that it's getting people who would not otherwise make contributions. Again, that gets back at the purpose of the tax credit. Is it really to get people who wouldn't contribute otherwise to contribute or what? And that's for other people to decide what the purpose of the tax credit is.
Norman.
I was interested in the graph about income versus utilization. Clearly, a lot more people in the higher income brackets use the credit than people at the lowest income bracket. And this, in sort of economic and motivational terms, it essentially shows that people who have very little income don't have enough money to invest in the political system because they don't get that credit back for over a year, perhaps. Or as little as 3 or 4 months. So if you don't have money to put into this, you can't get the credit back later. And so it amounts to sort of a regressive tax.
There is definitely, because of our system, there's a time element to it. So if it's March and I give $50, I won't get that back until the following April when I file. It's possible that I can adjust my withholdings and estimated payments, but the dollar amounts are so small, I don't see anybody really doing that.
Yeah.
At the low end, that's part of that comes in, part of your point gets at the potential refundability of the tax credit. That gets at some of that. And I think Minnesota actually has a process, and somebody might be more familiar than I am, they have a process where people make a contribution and they don't get a tax credit, but they can get a refund right away. I think they file. I'm not sure the mechanics.
So, follow up. In motivational terms, it's hard to motivate voters to make this investment in their political system because they don't see a return on it until much, much later. If the return or the motivation was more immediate, then we could probably get more participation.
And there might be some mechanics, some statutory changes to potentially address that if there could be changes to the withholding process or something. I don't – that would be an issue to explore. There might be something there.
I want to make sure anybody has a question.
I do.
Good one. Yeah, Senator.
So I have two questions, actually. So how many states – do you know how many states have a tax credit, a political tax credit?
I believe it's about half a dozen. I don't believe it's a large number.
Uh-huh. And then a tax expenditure report evaluates tax credits. What does it say about this one?
The Secretary of the State's office does the evaluation. not to put anybody on the spot.
You did.
But it's been difficult to evaluate. I mean,
that's something the audit division does.
Yeah, the audit division.
No,
yes, I'm sorry.
Yeah, okay.
That report notes, as is common with that report, the purpose isn't spelled out in statute. So the Department of Revenue assumes that the purpose is to get people involved in the process. Mm-hmm. And it's a challenging question because we can look at how many people claim and there's a lot of information who claims it and so forth. But tax returns themselves don't indicate if it makes people contribute who otherwise wouldn't, which is kind of the core question.
Right.
So it's an important question. It's the right question. It's just a difficult one to answer.
Right.
Wait, I was just thinking another variable that might be difficult to tease out is with a difference between people who prepare their own returns and those who have them done professionally. Because I would think when it's done professionally, they'd be more aware of the advantages of tax credit than people who are preparing their own returns.
Actually, yeah, we can get that information. And even further on that, we have electronically filed returns. So if somebody's using software, that software should be pretty good at prompting such questions. I can't speak to that directly, but I believe my general understanding is that they do. And yeah, we can get that information. So I can, if there's interest, I can get that and provide it to the task force.
I think it's just more whether people are aware of making use of the credit, and that's what I was thinking. People who file their own returns may not even sort of see it on as a line item on the return, but don't really recognize its use.
As somebody who files electronically by myself, it prompts you to ask that question.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Whether we now have numbers going down a little bit, partly because of the means testing, but the greater use of those things may keep us in a relatively good place in terms of people knowing.
Yeah, and for the electronically filed, the Department of Revenue publishes that information. It's upwards of 80 or 90% of filers now are using electronic means of filing their tax returns.
Either on their own or with a procurer. This is a little bit more comment than a question, but spending a lot of time these days thinking about 2008 compared to this year, open presidential being an election of a different character than actually even regular presidential elections, and the behavior of the campaigns as much as the issues. I mean, you raise a good point. You know, how excited is the electorate about this or that or the other that's on the ballot? But I think the other part, if there was really thorough research to be done, would be to see, you know, how much are the parties and nonprofits that are active in the political arena actively, you know, touting and, you know, doing their, and candidates doing their year-end, you know, don't forget your tax credit mailing, and if those rise and fall a little bit, that could have an impact as well.
Question from the phone.
Oh, yes,
Chair.
Please. Sure, Justin.
This is Justin. Great report. You've got two separate questions. The first one I think probably appropriate for LRO, and that's whether we could get some data on the number or percentage of voters who are prohibited from using the tax credit based on both the means testing legislation passed and then the filers who don't have any income to claim so couldn't make use of this. Is that something that is available?
Yes, I can get that information and send that to...
Great.
Yep.
And then the second question, probably for the chair, is whether we could have some research done, de-identified, of course, but that would give us a general sense of how the credit is used, to which groups or parties or candidates without taxpayer information, if that research could be done by the task force.
We can certainly see whether that's possible. We'll make a commitment of resources that I don't have. But
totally understand.
It's a question to note in our minutes and think about following up on. Great.
It seems like that would be hard, though, because we don't actually ask people to tell us who they gave it to. Right?
I think it's doable, but you need a database person to look at tax returns and correlate them with the individual contributions without providing any identification. It just seems like we should have a sense of how these tax dollars are used before we weigh in on it.
From the tax return side, we have SSNs. We have very confidential information on who claims the credit. I don't know about on the contribution side what kind of information is provided when somebody makes a contribution. I don't know that John or Jane Doe has to provide any, I don't know that they have to provide their SSN to make a contribution to a PAC or a candidate.
What percentage of the people are lying on their credit?
Madam Chair.
Yeah, I don't know either. It might be, it wouldn't be perfect information, but it's perhaps
some information, or STAR, obviously, for individuals who pay more than $50, but you could give $3 $30 contributions in a year and would not be captured as an individual.
Madam Chair, I mean, my sense is that there's two dynamics here. We're thinking about a $50 increment or a $100 increment when most people are contributing far and above. And this just happens to be one of the things they confidently claim because they got a receipt back. So I'm very, obviously, we support this tax credit. I'm dubious about enormous amounts of research to try and dissect a donor's or a person claiming the credit's thinking. There's also people who just don't claim the tax credit, even though they clearly could qualify for the tax credit, not solely because of ignorance, but just they don't see the need. They like their donations. They do things. And again, you know, we've done something to provide some incentive for participation and funding. I think I want to be careful before we go on research expeditions that, you know, may have actually a desired end, when really the point is people use this, they think it's a good use of their tax dollars, and we should be proud that we have 100,000 people who think this is a good idea.
Things for us to think about as we move forward, and whether, you know, what is the appropriate kind of analysis, or what's of most interest to know about this. I think, would collectively appreciate, Chris, the note you make that the purpose can get, you know, mucky. We started with purposes, and working to the specific gets mucky, and vice versa. I mean, obviously, we could look to legislative history. I wonder if informally you recall, I'm kind of assuming you were in the room for some of the discussion when they decided to go with making it means testing. Was it, you know, primarily a budget decision, primarily a this is a type of tax that we are now means testing, and therefore it fits in that bucket, or was there a particular motivation? We can certainly do our own research on legislative history, but
I think it's, speaking very generally, not speaking for any member, but generally, I think it was a combination of things. Just in general, there's an interest in means testing tax credits. So any tax credit that comes up, that's always an issue. And then there is kind of a revenue impact, a funding mechanism issue. And the way each session, as we're, the legislature is still pretty new in going through this tax credit review process. And each session is a little bit different, but roughly speaking, the Joint Committee on Tax Credits has been given a budget. And they've been given a budget of X dollars to spend on tax credits. So it's a matter of getting the tax credits that they want extended to fit into that bucket, if you will. So kind of those hand in hand. At the same time, the other tax credits that were up at that time, the Cultural Trust was one of them. So they take the credits that they want to extend, and how can they extend them within their budget constraints? And means testing is one way. So I would characterize it as a dual purpose, just general interest in means testing. As well as budget.
A question that you may not have an answer for this, but I'm curious, what fraction of total political contributions are accounted for by this tax credit? Is this a drop in the bucket, or is this something significant?
I actually don't know the number of total contributions. That's not something I've had a chance to look at yet.
That'd be a little easier research path for us, just to look at those. Noted as a possible question. Seth?
So there's a little bit of discussion on the progressivity question. Have you been able to compare, or do you plan on comparing for the report later with vouchers type systems where it's not done through the tax system, but so you can directly assign money that just gets sent by the state to a political entity to see whether or not one's more regressive or progressive than the other?
I hadn't thought about that yet, but that is the kind of thing I would expect we would include, because one of the backdrops for this tax credit reviews is whether or not there are other ways to achieve the purpose of the tax credit. So at a high level, tax credits are indirect spending, and if a direct spending program might be better suited to achieving a purpose. So the voucher system sounds like something like that. So I would expect we would look at that at some level.
I want to kind of keep the time in mind. There's other desperate to ask questions of Chris. We have a couple of follow-ups that he's actually quickly agreed to, so that's nice. The other questions we'll note and think about whether we can, put some additional energy into it as if this conversation goes forward. Incentivizing smaller donors has been one of the things that the task force has sort of come to some good agreement around as being a good thing. And so, obviously, this is why this is an important discussion. But anything else on that question for now? Thank you, Chris. And will you just post the slideshow or maybe?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, it is posted on our webpage under Media Materials for today. But I can also send it to you in a hard copy as well.
Okay. Good. Thank you, Chris. Appreciate it. We've kind of picked on a member to help us in the next one. I think many of you know that Representative Ray Field kind of took the bull by the horns and started to start the legislative conversation around perhaps a little more visibility of reporting in the independent expenditure arena, and had success and failure and all the in-betweens of a legislative.
And a lot of learning.
Yeah, and a lot of learning. So we asked him if he'd kind of let us know how that all went and what he got from it.
Yeah, so I can kind of, this group was, I mean, obviously the main focus, what it appeared to me as a member, was going towards the constitutional change. I felt, and I have felt for quite some time, just being involved in elections, that there are present things that we can do that are constitutional that can address a lot of the problems in our own system currently. And this group, and I think there was some interest in doing that, but, so this was something where we worked with the Secretary of State's office quite a bit to really address some of the current problems that we have. And none of this was intended to address big money in Oregon. That's not the purpose of this. So, that constitutional question was not something that we were really looking at. And I think if you use this last primary election is probably one of the best examples of some of the significant issues and problems we have in our campaign finance system here in Oregon. I mean, it really is much like the Wild West in a lot of ways. And so if you look at House District 44, the primary race that was up there, you had and it was a primary challenger, it was Speaker Kotek versus, could never pronounce the name. I don't know. It was Nasset. It was a primary challenge, and there was ongoing activity quite a bit. And you went for 2 months, and then only in the candidate's pack, only days before the election, was something ever filed. And so there's this failure to disclose, which is something that, I'll tell you a little bit about the bill, but that was something we really looked at. And essentially it kept the public in the dark about what was going on in this campaign for months. And that's not what we really think about it in our campaign finance realm. One of the other things is there were potentially, if you look at in-kind things that were actually spent, there were three pieces of literature that were widely distributed in that district. And there was none of these were recorded anywhere, not on an independent expenditure, okay, and not on in any in-kind contribution. So you have this more activity going on, and you don't know what's going on. There's not a way really to investigate this or have a lot of accountability with it. The Secretary of State's office doesn't have the resources to be able to do this. And one of the other interesting things is one of the main supporters of Speaker Kotek's opponent was Wolfpack. I mean, I think most of us knew that. And this was, potentially maybe some of these pieces of literature were being done through out-of-state expenditures or there were push phone calls, a lot of other things like that. Again, none of this was being reported on a PAC. Wolfpack never even filed a PAC in the state of Oregon. Again, there's this big issue with failure to disclose. And in the past, the Secretary of State's office would do these spot checks on our individual candidate or PACs looking at. Now, if we're filing, of course, we have stuff to back up what we're filing, but it's the absence of what we're filing is something that was never really being looked at. And that's part of the big problem that you have here.
Right, Will, can I interrupt you just for clarification? There have now been some things filed or information came forward to our elections folks on those after a lot of talk from us and trying to figure out, so just so that people don't, and we're still I think examining those filings and trying to understand them. They didn't quite match with what we had and so forth, so I think there's still investigation happening, but I don't want people to walk away and say that nobody ever filed anything. Ultimately the candidate did indicate, well, here I have something that it was very, very late, right up to election.
And we can kind of get at that. I mean, essentially, you had 2 months where nothing was being done. All of these things were being done, and the penalties in this situation are very minimal. And so what's, if you're strategically trying to game the system, and granted, this wasn't even a competitive race, but if we were in a competitive race and you wanted to game the system, the penalties are so minimal, the Secretary of State's office can't do anything really that could incentivize someone's behavior to change. And so people can strategically make a decision. And in fact, if you talk with treasurers around the system, sometimes people do make strategic decisions or want to make strategic decisions to withhold filing something just to take a penalty on it. These are things that currently go on in our system. And the ironic thing about this is you have Wolfpack, who was, arguing on campaign finance reform, yet potentially, and I don't know for sure, but, a lot of these oddities were out there, at least in this race. One of the other things that happened in that race was fraudulent publications that were, that appeared to wanted to deceive voters. That was another issue. And that's what's really what my bill was, initially sort of aimed to get at, was kind of the independent expenditure side and the transparency and the accountability. And so some of the things that we had in there was lowering the threshold of independent expenditures to $250. You have people form websites and just throw these websites up, which are, have the potential to impact lots of people in local county races or city races for city council. You have these multiple people that will gather together and collectively, say, with $500 each or $250 each, have the ability to impact a local race, which can have a dramatic impact, and the voters are kept in the dark with those. So that was part of what we did. Some of the other things that we really focused on was we really want to have a better way to search independent expenditures on the Secretary of State's website. Well, right now, I kid you, yesterday I was trying to explain it to somebody else, and it took a legislator and another legislator about 10 minutes. Even though I've done this before, I had to figure out where the heck is that button. And there's like a little toggle, and it's a little bit confusing. And what we would like to be able to do is be able to search by individual, but also be able to search by campaign. So we could see all of the independent expenditures going into one campaign, creating more transparency, by a real simple change. And that's probably, in talking with the Secretary of State's office, a very easy fix. And then some of the other things that we really wanted to do was focusing on that absence, the failure to disclose, where if someone isn't disclosing, and really turn this into more of kind of like an IRS audit, if you will, where there's some randomization to when somebody's going to be audited, and the Secretary of State's office would have the ability to gather the bank account for this, a fraction of these campaign committees, and be able to match them up with OrStar. Because if you're only spot checking, again, you don't know what's exactly what's what in a given situation. The other component of that would be where they would have a little bit more power through the investigation side. Again, kind of getting at some of the things that happened in the House district race, where they would have the ability, if there was an independent expenditure or these issues right there, and they had reasonable suspicion was the level threshold that we had, that you'd be able to access the bank records for this PAC or for that individual in the given situation. Let's see here. There was a couple of other little minor things in here, but that was essentially the main points of really what we were trying to do. The other side of that is, you know, in kind of hindsight, this bill actually passed out of rules with a do-pass recommendation, went to Ways and Means. We had to, it made sense that we needed to, you needed to give the resources to the Secretary of State's office to be able to do these things, and so this would cost some money. And, of course, with our looming budget shortfall in the next session, these types of asks become even more difficult. But you, we couldn't do these types of things with the existing resources, so that was, and it got to Ways and Means and died at that point. One of the other things I think that this bill could potentially be made better, and I'll be reaching back out to the Secretary of State's office, is potentially do we want to have some ability to require entities who are spending money in this state, and if they're going to spend collectively, say, over $2,500 in, you know, a combination of races in the state of Oregon, do we want to force them to file a PAC? So that way, you know, for instance, you know, somebody who's out of state, they come in here and they pepper all of the various candidates with money. We could go to their PAC and we could see the money coming in, and then we could see it all be distributed out. Again, trying to include a little bit more transparency. I'm not, you know, these are just ideas. I'm not saying we should or shouldn't do that. One of the other interesting things that I kind of found out was you have balance adjustments in the Secretary of State's office. And for full disclosure, I had a 20-cent balance adjustment recently on my own Secretary of State's website. My PAC was inactive for a period.
How much was that?
20 cents. 20 cents. But Representative Kenmer, this is the fascinating thing. Here's the fascinating thing about a balance adjustment. If I take in $20,000 of contributions, I don't report them. Just take it into my bank account. Nobody's gonna know. Then I spend $10,000 of expenditures out of my bank, or let's say I spend $9,999.80 out of my PAC, okay? I just do a 20-cent balance adjustment. Nobody's any wiser. And so all of that, which would have been subject to penalties, is now a 20 cent adjustment. So I think that there's ways that we could potentially fix that. You know, what I would, and as Kenmer's heard me say multiple times, a loophole. And then the other side of that is I think some of the penalties in this bill, I'm not necessarily happy with where it is. We increased the penalties from a maximum of 10% to 40%. The one thing I don't like about the way that we've done it is there's a lot of folks that are just innocent filers that, you know, they make a simple mistake once, they make a simple mistake twice. I don't really want to be punitive with folks like that, but the repeat offenders, the folks that are consistently doing this, the folks that are playing games, having some way to be able to make that distinction, and quite frankly, folks that are playing games and doing stuff like that should probably be higher than 40% of what's going on. And then the other side, you know, the addition that I think we should be looking at is the some sort of catch for kind of fraudulent publications or publications that are meant to deceive voters, and doing something along those lines. So that's kind of like the full where I've come. And again, this is a work in progress, and I need to get back with the Secretary of State's office because I know you're going, oh my gosh, she's got more ideas. so that's where I'm at currently.
And
with
if
the
I
process.
Could, because it's certainly been important to me that is chair of this group that not be jumping ahead of the group with Secretary of State proposals to throw at folks. When legislators have proposals, we are required to work with them, not to say we wouldn't do it willingly, and the elections team will provide all the best background we can, even in our own protection, if nothing else, so that that they understand. So these were bills that I think we were neutral on the bill itself, but, you know, liked certain changes and were, you know, supportive of certain things. I just want to make that clear because I did feel self-conscious about sort of wanting to have the consensus of this group, you know, move us in that direction. And but I think the legislative discussion is very valuable then back to West. I mean, the kinds of things that came up as a result of that. So
one thing I noticed in the statutes is there's a statute that allows you to challenge elections if an election law violation changed the outcome of the election. But you have to challenge it formally. Then there's this court process. And if it doesn't change the outcome of the election, then the loser pays the attorney fees and stuff. And so there's a huge disincentive for people to challenge the elections, even when there is an election law violation. at the matter. For example, and I was thinking of this because Nestle, for example, spent huge amounts of money, record-breaking money, in Hood River County on a ballot measure to try and get change water rights so they could get access to the water. And the they didn't file anything until the last minute that they had actually spent money, that they were actually the ones opposing the ballot measure. And that could have potentially, like, it was a landslide against Nestle, but if Nestle won, then the campaign, which had, like, no money, could have appealed it. But then they would have had to prove to a court that it definitely changed the outcome of the election. But if people didn't know that they were being manipulated by Nestle without any knowledge because it wasn't transparent. And that's a hard thing to prove. So is there, maybe we need to say, if there's an election law violation that actually did occur, then the loser doesn't have to pay. It's a question of whether or not it actually...
Pay for your, you make the violation, you pay for the trial, so...
Well, I'm just saying, if there is a violation, then each side could pay their own legal fees. Okay. Something as simple as that. But if there's no violation that did occur, then the loser could still pay.
What statute is that?
We don't have our elections team with us today. One is out in Astoria, and the other, we're still counting votes. So, we're still working
later,
with counties. We can certainly, it's something that we could ask for a little bit of more information about is the...
As an attorney, I'm going, my goodness, how do you prove that it would change the outcome?
Exactly. It's a real... pretty tough standard. Yeah. Fly by that one.
So, Norman, other questions?
I think, Representative Kenner was ahead of me. Well, I wanted to comment on the audit. I think there used to be a random audit provision in the election statute, but somehow that is no longer there.
I could speak to the history of that, not personally because I was there, but because I've heard about it many, many times, that there was a time when they were random spot checks. I don't think they were called audits, and I'm not sure that they reached bank accounts. I could be wrong. But what was found was that there was an enormous amount of time doing this, enormous amount of time building records of those spot checks. They were not looked at or used by virtually anybody. A very small number of them ever produced a, here's something big. And at some point, I think it may have been a Secretary of State who brought it to them, but I think that the legislature agreed that that particular process was not a useful one. Whether there's another way to go about
when
it, some of the discussions was happening.
When was that taken out of the statute?
Within the last 5 years, I'm thinking, right? Was it longer than that? Or?
Madam Chair, it was 2009.
And so I knew Aaron would know this.
Yes, right.
Norm, the background on that, just so you know, is that's spot. You're basically spot checking the folks that are complying.
Yes.
So it's like basically checking the speed and the slow lane on the highway, right? You want to be checking the fast lane. So
the other part of my question was that I don't think that there's in the statute now any provision for if a complaint was made during a campaign that you'd have the subpoena power to actually go look at the campaign and see if something like withholding disclosure was actually occurring. I don't think that exists either, does it?
There isn't. There, I believe, and Robert will come up and burn set us here on fire if I'm really going over the line here. There might be a situation where there is sufficient evidence that a crime has occurred that we could engage the Attorney General's office and do something. But the reality is our investigative powers in and of ourselves are fairly simple and straightforward to make the inquiries, to do our best.
Right.
To
I was
get
talking
the
about the Elections Department's investigative powers are fairly limited.
Yeah. That's right. But I don't want to say it would never happen, right? Am I right, Robert? It would probably have to be serious criminal behavior that underlay what was happening and some evidence of that.
Well, I'd say that was pretty serious, though, if there was entities that weren't disclosing at all, then...
This happens all the time, though. Yeah, and like I have, you know, like a personal story in my own in an own race that I've had where, an amazing person. This wasn't a malicious thing. I just don't think this individual understood the rules, right? And then you have more egregious side of things, right? So it's an interesting. I think you've got a. It's not always, I think, black and white when someone violates the law, right? So it's, but in some cases, that's certainly egregious, right?
Yeah. Ignorance is one thing, but strategic play is certainly a different matter.
So on the complaints process, the way I understand it is there's a civil and criminal component to it. If it's just the election law violations, then it doesn't really ever go to the Attorney General. The Secretary of State's office handles it directly. But if it's a criminal situation, then they would refer it to the Attorney General. But the problem is they're the ones who are supposed to be referring it to the Attorney General's office, but they don't have any investigative powers to even determine that. So it doesn't get to the point where it can even then go to an actual investigation because there's this filter where the entity isn't able to actually investigate it. Having filed election law complaints before, I've seen that basically work out.
I do see criminal investigation to go forward to the ADG's office.
Yeah, if it's obvious.
It doesn't not happen.
It just has to be really, like, absurdly obvious. Blatant.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wanted to go back to an earlier notion. Something that's always been of interest to me is greater transparency. And I really like that notion of a search by campaign, because sometimes it's hard to discover the names of some of these independent expenditures and other operations, as well as then to know where to find them. And if we can search by campaign, I mean, that might be a feasible way to make the process transparent. It doesn't always stop the game playing.
Right.
Yeah. I don't want to ignore the people on the phone again if you feel like you're having to shout. Is there anybody on the phone that has a question?
I just have a quick question, Representative Rayfield, about your bill dying in Ways and Means, providing additional resources to the Secretary's office. Are we talking millions of more dollars in order to follow up?
I think what we, and again, I would always defer, and I always have to say, that, boy, the Secretary of State's office was very accommodating to me and my, how should I put it, my high maintenance needs on this bill throughout the short session, so we were trying to initially we were thinking, if you did, like, for instance, the audits and the investigations, the audits would be very small, but amongst candidates, once someone gets audited, you go, holy moly, I better get my act together, right? Because it could be me any day, and so there would have been a small percentage, and then on the other side we were thinking the investigations, giving them more resources in that component. We'd only anticipated potentially two positions, and of course I would love to do more. And I would defer to their office to say what would make this successful. The other side was there was going to be some cost to change the website and a little bit of cost in that in that way as well. So.
And it just seems like what you were proposing would entail some fairly modest increase in resources to the Secretary's office. Rush to get the session over.
I think the tough part is we are facing mathematical $1.3 billion shortfall in the next cycle, and so sitting on the Ways and Means Committee, looking at these things, how do we? This is a type of expenditure that would have rolled up, because it's staffed into the next budget, which then continues to go from there. So that is, it didn't rise to the level of concern, I think, to. Especially when we've got the budget shortfalls coming. So,
okay, thank you.
So I do have a question. It addresses the full disclosure and disclaimer, and so party structure. We have federal PAC, and we have federal laws, and we have state laws, and under the federal PAC, we have to disclaim everything with authorized and paid for by and not authorized by any campaign or campaign committee. And on the state side, most of that's gone away. And so, and I think on the federal side, the idea is that if you have to put your name on the piece, you may be less likely to say something that isn't factual. So I was just curious, in the full disclosure, disclaiming, we did away with that and could have opened the door for some of this that's taking place, because if you don't have to put your name on it and you can use some PAC name that isn't there, we might want to revisit the disclaimers on at least printed material, and we're required on our web page, on our Facebook. Everything has to be disclaimed so that we can prove that it came from the party, not from somebody out there fictitiously slandering a candidate on the other side or one of our candidates.
As I think most people know, the legislature did take that statute off the books. It was whether the direct result or indirect result of an attorney general opinion that was not possible to continue to enforce that under the state constitution. So we're getting back to one of our sort of fundamental, you know, do we need a constitutional provision and want to support that in order to be able to get that disclaimer?
You know, we were looking at this too, because specifically the example that Representative Rayfield cited in District 44, you had this kind of mock voters pamphlet go out, and to this day it's not really even clear who paid for it and who distributed it. And even though we can go under ORSTAR and see Americans Take Action, I think was the name of the PAC, that spent like $4,100, we can only see that they spent $4,100 on print materials. But we still don't know those print materials were the fake voters pamphlet ad. So we looked into this whole, the fact that we don't have disclaimer laws, and you know, it was true that Attorney General Harding Myers wrote this legal opinion in 1999 saying that that wouldn't hold up anymore under state and federal courts, and that would be struck down, so the legislature repealed in 2001. It might be worthwhile discussing whether or not we could request the Attorney General take a second look at that legal opinion, because it was written almost 20 years ago. They cite a lot of federal cases, although federally, as you mentioned, we still do, of course, have paid for by requirements, and we do, and I think 46 other states have paid for by requirements too. It's actually just Oregon, Georgia, Mississippi, and Arkansas that don't. And so there's clearly some case study showing that federally paid for by statements can still be allowed. And then, of course, I'm not an attorney, but in Oregon, we have had a shift in our, you know, we have had new justices come on. We've had a shift in how people talk about disclosure and transparency, certainly post-Citizens United. So it might be worthwhile asking a current attorney general to take another look at that opinion and see if she still feels that that is valid. Because as noted in the opinion, the Oregon Supreme Court never has actually ruled on this subject. So there's never actually a case that we're pointing to specifically.
Yeah, it has been long argued that that was not something that was litigated to decision, and so was it really necessary for the legislature to take action? Mm-hmm. That could come from a number of different directions, that kind of request, but keeping on the list, so, Representative?
Yeah, I really like this idea. I think transparency is, you know, and there's, I don't know, under this freedom of speech, there's an interesting question. Am I free to say what I wish and not have any accountability? And I think I'm free to have freedom of speech, but I don't think I'm free from accountability. If I say that you're a cheater, I ought to be able to be forced to justify that comment. And that's where I come down. And somehow they managed to do this federally. And I found that quite offensive that we changed that standard. I understand it protects some folks, and some folks don't want to take responsibility for what they say or do. But I think the idea of asking, we have a new attorney general, maybe there would be a different perspective, or maybe there would be a suggested route to achieve that.
And it would at least clarify whether or not we have to have a constitutional amendment in order to authorize in Oregon, or could we just pass it by statute?
Yeah,
and that itself would be an important answer.
Constitutional amendment, that gets a little more complicated. Mm-hmm. Maybe there's a different way to root it.
I'm thinking, and I won't cut you off, Kyle, if your question is, I'm thinking this obviously helps, starts off a little bit of a conversation that we plan to have coming up about what are the issues that we think we might have some more consensus on than we have, and where we go from here. So I think this is for ongoing discussion, but if there are other questions of Representative Rayfield based on what he was trying to do there, can we get those? And Kyle, you can either save or go.
Just very briefly, I wanted to dispel the apparent consensus in the room that we should always have to disclose identities of people doing political speech. Anonymous political speech has a proud history in this country, back to the Federalist Papers, and by not putting names on things, you can avoid the sorts of identity politics problems where you don't listen to someone because of who they are. You should pay attention to the message, not the speaker. Anonymous speech helps you do that.
That's always going to be. We're going to always have some of that in these conversations. Robert, my deputy back here, and the rest of us from the Secretary of the State's office can tell you, trying to determine whether or not we actually have authority over the state territorial seal, as opposed to the actual state seal, which we do have authority over, created another whole interesting thing with that mailing. And we had a non-election interest in the way that mailer was formatted as well. And did our best to find out who and let them know that it was not appropriate. I'm going to suggest we take a little 7-minute maybe break till 10:25, and then come back and gather our energy to talk about the future a little bit. And without any objection to that, we're. Task force will come back to order.
Thanks.
I'm going to try not to keep you until noon and the last possible moment, but the next part will depend on kind of the discussion that you all want to be sure to have. By way of introduction, obviously there were a number of communications during the February session and after from and to all of you, and back and forth amongst you, I'm sure, and obviously there was great disappointment, at least on behalf of those who voted in favor of our resolution, maybe not so much disappointment on the folks who did not, that a vehicle was not created for us, and subsequently, although there was a bill that might have or a House Joint Resolution or a Senate Joint Resolution or both that could potentially have been taken up, they were not. I think what I committed to you all was to pause and try to have some thoroughgoing conversations with the presiding officers about their expectations for the task force. I think probably the record will show, and you can argue with me if you think I'm misrepresenting, but I think we did sort of initially acknowledge the fact that while we were not going to require absolute consensus in order to move something forward, that the less we were at consensus with that recommendation, likely the less political energy that there would be behind it, or the more difficult it would be to move something on behalf of the task force. The whole issue of having bills or not, I think you all know I did draft something, although I didn't have the authority to introduce. Agencies don't have the ability during the short sessions to introduce, and that's a little bit of a separate but ongoing conversation with the presiding officers, and a strong recommendation for me that in particular when you have a task force that has been created, that it's important to try to make room for that process to happen. That was disappointing to me as well, no question about it. But at any rate, the kind of lengthy conversations, some more shorter than others, to try to tease out what might be work that we could accomplish that would then potentially gain the support of leadership to move forward. It repeatedly came down to the issue of greater consensus versus less consensus. And I think the presiding officer's hope from the beginning, and it may have been a really challenging one, given this issue and the strong positions that are held all around most of the issues involved them, to have an expectation. But I think they had harbored some hope that there would be a unifying, if not unanimous, more unifying proposal to come from the task force. And so part of what I would like to do in this discussion coming up, and we can focus on the various substantive issues, which I tried to list, at least the ones that are kind of the bigger ones that are there, or just on to speak to it generally. But I'm sure that for the time and energy of you all who have lives and other responsibilities, and certainly from my standpoint, I kind of want to feel encouraged by ourselves, within ourselves, that there is a path to something that might gain greater consensus before we embark on a series of meetings where we, reflect. I think our task force report, for the final report, and if you haven't looked at it in a while, please do. There is a minority report that was filed. I think it has a lot of parallels in it because I think many, if not all, of the issues raised in the minority report were identified also in the task force report, and we didn't, I don't think, try to make it sound like it was people were unanimous on some of the different points. I think did identify some of the challenges that we had in reaching more of a consensus for recommendations. But I feel like before you all commit yourselves and I commit myself to some additional investment in time that we think about and see if we can arrive at a place where we feel like some or all of these issues are worth investing. And the first question that I put on the table, and I'll just say it, and then you can go back to perhaps having a different version of my introduction if you want to do that. But my first question, out of the box for myself was, is there information, is there research, are there questions to be answered that would substantially, potentially, we can never make promises, not expecting people to make promises, potentially move the needle in terms of how great a proportion of this group could support the original resolution, or to do that. If there are honestly, if I knew this, and if we really had better information about that, I could potentially, see, moving that direction, then it may be worth continuing to discuss. And I know this puts you all a little bit on the spot, and particularly poor Representative Kennemer, who just got to the table and doesn't want to necessarily. And I know particularly for folks who do represent organizations, you've got board positions and, volunteer people and a lot of people to answer to in that regard. But you've been part of these discussions, and you kind of see where the divisions lay, I think, or I hope, from looking at our report, if not from being in it personally. You know, what are our chances of getting to, you know, 60, 75, you know, let alone getting to 100%? And I don't think 100% is necessarily the requirement. It's more a question of something that will, in fact, help to bring, you know, that will speak to a majority of legislators that this was a considered, you know, positive opinion. Does that sound like a trick question and I should back away from it? Or I wonder if folks have comments or questions about my transition statement there. I could go around and make you all speak.
I mean, Madam Secretary, you understand that we opposed the moving forward of that resolution. And in my belief, probably one of the only productive conversations would be about public financing issues. Our concern is that all efforts to specifically limit campaign contributions may be desirable in the current context, does nothing but drive enormous amount of resources into independent expenditures, into dark money activities, which, as we think, is absolutely an unintended counterproductive step. And I think what you're saying is there a productive area for us to put in energy? And it seems to me there's kind of two routes we could have productive energy. One is just as an efficient way to up our education level on things like the political tax credit, like the four things you list here, and that somehow or another, maybe we see something that emerges. I think Representative Rayfield's work is almost spot on to an example of things that we might say we believe in this, even there may be members of the committee who don't feel as comfortable. And I'm as committed as anyone. I just think in the current context of Citizens United, we're in an environment where, you know, we're coming up to an accident, someone is bleeding from both arteries, and we're putting a lot of pressure on one artery, and we think we're saving the patient, and we're not. And I just want to make sure we put our productive energy in an area that we think will actually take the step forward we can take step forward. I also want to be very clear, the party I represent strongly opposes Citizens United and wants to see that day change, but until we get there, I want to find the steps we can take that make the system better.
Dave. One thing in terms of both Representative Rayfield's efforts and what Brad just said is I think one of our first meetings we had a briefing on how the elections office operates within the secretary's office. I think it would be valuable to get a more comprehensive overview of that in terms of what are the tools the secretary's office currently has in regard to oversight on campaign finance. What you have available, what you can do, and by that I mean what you have the resources to do, and are there things you on paper could do but you can't because you lack the resources?
Thank you. Anybody else want to?
And I think because that was months ago that we had that, I think bringing us back up to speed there, I think would be valuable.
We can wait till after June 16th, no matter what. Indeed, Kyle.
I'll second what Mr. Ellis just said. And from my perspective, I would say that the things that may be more productive for us to look at are, as Mr. Rayfield pointed out, some of the disclosure issues, particularly with people not disclosing strategically, and also the area of voluntary agreements. Although to the extent that they're fully voluntary, perhaps the state doesn't have a role to play.
I would note, I think Representative Bueller suggested creating templates or having, you know, technical resources could happen, you know, no matter what. I'm not speaking in support of that so much as to say I know that he has a Secretary of State role that and all of that. Yep, Representative Rachel.
And I would just kind of, from a political reality from within the building, when you have both major parties, which consist of all of the members in both chambers, it's going to be very difficult, I think, to move, you know, a constitutional amendment through the building, just from a political reality standpoint, right? And so I think I like the idea of trying to find some ideas selfishly right? Some ideas that that we all agree on and coming together. Because one thing that's really apparent for me is that when you sit in, you know, if I'm sitting in my office with staff in the Secretary of State's office, we have a limited, you know, we have a limited mindset. But when you bring in folks like Seth, who like bring in a lot of good ideas, or the rest of us that have a lot, and quite frankly, Kyle, some of your comments earlier today, like kind of go, oh, that's very interesting. I mean, like really, it's thought provoking, right? And I think the more heads you have on this, I mean, I think we could come up with more comprehensive solutions to some problems that I think we could get to a consensus on. Although, I certainly appreciate and, you know, and I agree that there is a larger problem that we have, in agreeing with what Brad said with Citizens United. So that's kind of where I probably, if we were going to continue this, I would like to see something come out of here as a consensus, hey, here's what our recommendations are. And I think that gets us more likely to actually, practically speaking, get something passed through the building.
Thank you. I'm still trying to get up to speed and catch up a little bit with what you said. On the other hand, I've also been a participant and a recipient of some interesting experiences. I ran for the first time in 1985-86, so it's been quite a bit of experience. In 94, I had the second most expensive campaign in the legislature. And in 2008, when I returned to the House, my opponent spent $611, and that was the reported amount. Pause. And I spent about $425, which is astronomical and ridiculous, frankly. And, of course, we've superseded that by substantial numbers now, and we'll undoubtedly do that. I guess a couple of things. One is I would concur with Representative Rayfield that I think going the constitutional amendment is a tough go in the legislature. So I think we ought to look at other alternatives. With these specifically, I think voluntary agreements are good ideas, and that might be something we could push. On the other hand, they're not very enforceable, and there are a lot of people who would not be included, independent expenditures and a lot of other things. So I'm not sure how successful that is, but at least it helps maybe set a tone. And additional reporting disclosure requirements, going back to my earlier comment, I really think part of freedom of speech is responsibility, too, and it's a balance. And I think we should hold people accountable, and I really would like to see us explore. If you're willing to make a statement, you ought to be willing to take responsibility for it. And one of the things that's happened in my experience personally and also with others is untruthful things are said, and that's harmful. And it's hard to dispute them. And some of them are just points of difference. And, you know, you have a blue jacket, or is that a gray jacket? it's kind of interesting. We can argue about some of those things. But
It's certainly blue.
Thank you. I'm glad you saw the wisdom. it's... But I think there are some things that we can do with requiring disclosure, because people would be less apt to say things. And I got to say, seeing some of the repercussions that have come to different groups and individuals for having participated, particularly with large sums of money when it gets out, who it was, that's difficult. On the other hand, I think it's important to know. And for me, it's a credibility issue. You know, when I get information, one of the first things I do is I look to see who it's from, because we all have our biases and they have their biases. And I just think it's fair to know who this is from and who's funding it. I think that's fundamental to a good election process that's fair, is to know, well, who's supporting these people and what are they saying? I'm not sure we need more penalties, because we're having trouble enforcing the ones we have, and it gets difficult to prove guilt. But I think we do want to encourage compliance and quicker compliance. We are spending a fortune, and we're one of the highest spending states in the nation on campaigns. On the other hand, getting into public funding, especially when we have deficits that we are facing, I do not see as viable. So
first I want to say that I do think Secretary Atkins worked really hard to try to find an opening to move this forward. I don't know what she could possibly have done that she didn't try, and so I really applaud her for doing that. But I keep coming back to this task force is a task force on campaign finance reform. And, you know, voluntary agreements, things like that, could happen anyway, would not require the law to be changed at all. And we could talk about that, but I don't really think it addresses the real problem. I think the recommendation that we came up with, although it might be imperfect, is where the public is on this issue, overwhelmingly. I mean, every time the public gets a chance to vote on this, they support it. And those of us, you know, I think everybody here spends a lot of time talking to people about this issue, and overwhelmingly, people want to see some action. So, you know, to me, if we can't do something close to what we've already recommended or try to find a way to perfect it, even though everybody here might not support it, I hate to be a wet blanket, but I kind of wonder what we're really doing here, because a lot of these other ideas could happen anyway, and I'm not sure they would really address the problem or what the public expects us to do about that problem. And to me, you know, I came to the table hoping that that's what we would work on, and it's still where I am, and I wish we could find a way to get there.
Yeah, I think not to, not to move away from what was said about transparency or enforcement of current laws, because I think that those are really so crucial, and we do need to see how that fits in with what we have now. But to answer your initial question, Secretary Atkins, about a constitutional amendment, I think one thing we haven't really explored is there a role for a constitutional amendment authorizing contribution limits if it's complementary to another policy? And we've talked about it in isolation. You know, I think certainly Common Cause feels like it would be a fundamental and elemental reform to pass. But, we definitely recognize the concerns that people have about shifting money over to independent expenditures. And we want to make sure whatever policy we adopt is responsible and doesn't ignore that potential reality. You know, I think if it's complemented with another policy, though, is that something that would address those initial concerns? And so, like, for instance, public funding is, you know, a really exciting and perhaps comprehensive approach to this issue, and we're seeing it pass and, you know, other cities and other states. Washington State looks like it might pass at the ballot in November this year. So a lot of localities are moving in that direction. But usually they are matched with contribution limits, because the you can't force people to join a public financing system legally. And so you want to make sure that they can't raise more money outside of the public financing system than within it. And that's where contribution limits often play a role. And so every other state that has a public financing system, like, you know, Washington, Arizona, Maine, all these other locations, they do have limits that make sure people have an incentive to raise more money within the public financing system. So I think my question is, if a constitutional amendment to authorize contribution limits is where a lot of people are, but there are some concerns about what it would do to independent expenditures, are there policies that would be matched with a constitutional amendment that would complement it, that would address those concerns?
So as people were repeating their concerns about contribution limits and Citizens United, I think it's possible to
have a policy such as if you have contribution limits on, say, a per race level, maybe they wouldn't apply if an independent expenditure appeared that was really high. But at the same time, in order to do that, you need the disclosures to come quickly enough to allow the contribution limits to be raised fast enough. So I think with a little bit more work, we could get to something where we could have contribution limits, but conditioned on expenditure limits, not just public financing, although that's one of the reasons why public financing has a hard time, because people are also concerned not just about contribution limits, but the fact that independent expenditures get spent. But by tying it to the independent expenditures or expenditures in general, that may be the key to getting consensus among everybody. And I just wonder if people are open to that idea as a workaround. And I know, like Brad was saying, Citizens United is the current situation, but I disagree. Citizens United only has a 4-4 vote and at this point, so it's not really, it wouldn't hold up, I think. So I think we should go after Citizens United and directly ourselves.
Yeah, I mean, Madam Chair.
Just going to say, can we make sure that we've heard from everybody on kind of an initial thought before we get into some back and forth about that?
I'll step into it on research. So it's become very apparent. So in the party structure, we get involved in all levels of campaigning. So all the way down to mayors, city council, so on, and all of them are report to a different election officer. But all of them take contributions, and all of them have the right to do tax credits. So I guess my question would be, besides looking at what the Secretary of State's office does, I would like to know for the county election clerks, what their process is for where they may be the election officer, and if we put into campaign limits, is it going to go all the way down to my city councilor, or is it going to stop at the legislature, so we have a feel for when we're talking to our county structures, are we doing something that's going to affect them and their candidates, or are we talking about legislative and above?
Question? I don't want to pick on people. I'm just sort of hoping everybody will speak if they have something to say, at least initially. Justin, are you there?
Oh, yeah, sorry. I was on mute.
That's okay. I'm sure you were eloquent while on mute.
I still think we have work to do and that there is purpose to this group, and I kind of go back to where we agreed on our principles at our very first meeting. I think there is too much money in our election system, and it is a real problem that we have to address. Where I and some others came down in disagreement with the final report was if we rush forward with contribution limits, whether through a constitutional amendment or any other means, we have a very obvious problem. It's reality that super PACs and independent expenditures exist. We've seen it on the federal level. And I think that that would be a horrible outcome for Oregon, with a system with less disclosure and more dark money, and we already have a hard enough time finding out where some of these misleading ads come from. So with that fundamental problem, which I don't have an answer to, I want us to continue to focus on that. But aside from the thorny constitutional issues, I think we've got opportunities for enhanced disclosure. I think we all agreed that the Secretary of State's office deserves more audit and investigation powers and funding to do so. I think we need to continue to look at both the purpose and the operation of the political tax credit, particularly now that a smaller slice of the electorate is electing a credit. I really like the idea of looking at the People's Pledge and giving candidates that enter into that some formal recognition for doing so to give them a boost, and am open to even looking at public funding in correlation with a People's Pledge system. I don't know what it would look like. I think we got a lot of research to do, but I'm by all means still vested in this and want us to move forward.
Start with? Go ahead. Thank you.
Well, I can subscribe to much of what's already been said. Certainly, Brad, and your interest in independent expenditures and public disclosure is right on target. And I think that the fact that we're concerned with getting people to buy into that kind of system brings us back to the need for contribution limits. And I think everybody but Brad has heard me talk about the three-legged stool analogy, and that the first leg is contribution limits, the second leg is increased disclosure and enforcement, and then the third leg is public financing of some sort. As far as public financing is concerned, I'd like to replace our political tax credit with something that is more motivational and immediate for the people who are interested in investing in our political system. Something like the voucher system that was passed in Seattle, perhaps we could consider, or maybe the matching system that was instituted in New York City, a 6-to-1 match, would be motivating to many people. And limited by means if you want, because that would then bring it down to smaller contributors. As far as voluntary systems, even if we don't have contribution limits, a voluntary system could have some beneficial effect. The People's Pledge system that was used in Massachusetts could be backed up by some statutory changes that would reward candidates that buy into the system by recognition, say, in the voter's pamphlet with a seal of campaign finance goodness or whatever you want to call it, or something that they could include in their ads that is copyrighted and only people who buy into the People's Pledge would be able to use. Those kind of things would help motivate candidates to buy into the system. There's lots that we can do. I have a report that is 80 pages long from an attorney that was submitted to a law journal that says essentially, what can we do after Citizens United? And it concludes that there's still a lot that can be done. And after I take a look at it again, I might ask that you distribute it to the group. But there is, I think, plenty that we can do, even within the restrictions and roadblocks that the courts have put in our place in front of us. So I'm not giving up, so hope you won't either.
Please send that up.
Kyle, I know you did distribute to everybody at least sort of a thought process around evaluating sort of some of the philosophical points that we had early, and we're concerned there. Is there something you want to add to that?
Not add substantively to it. I don't know. When I had sent that out, I had no way to know how much appetite there might be in the group for potentially veering away from what we started with, doing campaign finance, and talk more generally about the problems that we see. I think it would be a valuable exercise, but if it brings us too far afield from our mission, then it's out of scope and we shouldn't do it. But I would love to see more examination of what we think the problems are, especially why we think there are problems, because that would greatly inform the solution space.
Nikki and Rob, you should feel the laser coming at you here.
We're supportive of the constitutional amendment. We're interested in looking at options of public financing. I also want to commend Representative Rayfield for trying to find other solutions to the gridlock that I think we face. The other thing that I think is really important in this conversation is to bring in additional communities. We set a lot of different community-based conversations across Oregon, trying to figure out ways to figure out campaign finance reform, and often there are people who are not at the table who often have other voices or other solutions to their problems. So to the extent that we can bring in more people to the conversation to find these solutions, I think the better off we will be. I think that that's where we're at, as we're trying to find equitable solutions to the problems.
Rob, you can say no.
I wanted to listen to people first.
Okay, very good.
Madam Chair, excuse me. There are some people who are listening in and don't know who's speaking, and maybe we could be a little clearer about who is speaking.
Okay, I think we only have Justin on the phone now.
Well, aren't there some other people who are listening in through the system of the legislature?
Okay.
And so I got a concern that they don't know who's talking, and it's helpful to know.
Maybe we'll let Rob speak, and then we'll make sure and go around the room. Rob is representing the third major party and at the table, the Independent Party of Oregon. So
Independent Party. I call it the minor major party.
That's a good one.
So a couple of comments. First, I totally agree with Senator Rosenbaum that because the constitutional amendment sort of is the linchpin to a lot of this, because if we're looking at it as a package, if you don't have that, you limit your options available within the package. For instance, contribution limits combined with matching funds or some sort of a voucher system combined with the People's Pledge is much more effective than not. That being said, a couple of us have talked during the interim between meetings about what kind of a non-constitutional package would look like, and Norm pretty much laid it out. And I think we could get some broader consensus across philosophical lines if we pursued that as well. I don't think we should ignore or give up on the constitutional amendment, because the fact of the matter is, even if Citizens United were to be overturned, Oregon would still be a Citizens United state without it. And if someone really hates or dislikes Citizens United, we should also be looking at the Oregon Constitution to make sure that when it is overturned, that we're not still under the same regimen. Absent that, it's going to be a continuing problem, and I think we all know that. So I think it is sort of a two-prong approach. Do what we can do now with broad consensus, not just with broad consensus on a package that we can do, continue, I think, to make the recommendation to at least do something constitutionally to allow us to use products that are out there that can be part of an overall package. And the last thing I guess I would say, and I think I mentioned this at the very first meeting, is that sometimes when we talk about campaign finance reform, I think what we're talking about is not necessarily money in politics. We're talking about whether money can adversely influence political decisions that are not really broadly supported by the people, but instead by the folks who are supplying the money. And it's really hard to identify that, as Kyle pointed out in his last email to us. And maybe it never happens. But it's a concern, and if nothing else, it's an appearance that I think we're all concerned with. And I think if we were going to broaden, or maybe not for this particular panel or task force, but for the legislators to think about, and I know it was thought about in the last full legislative session, was actually a task force on electoral reform. Because some of this is driven by how our elections work. First past the post voting, those sorts of things causes people to act or use different sorts of tactics. It's a difficult discussion to have, I'm guessing, within this building, because when you talk about that, you're talking about making races more competitive to reduce the influence of a single donor. And that's not always a comfortable discussion to have. But it one way to address some of this perceived problem of the connection between winning elective office and donations or money is to review the election process. And that's beyond the scope of this task force, but I just wanted to raise that issue.
Have Have I missed somebody? Well, let me just offer a couple quick things, and then we can think about how we might like to proceed. I started to think, as people were talking, in the package mode, but also maybe addressing some of the fear and loathing that there is around, you know, changing the Constitution means a future legislature can do a lot of things, and maybe they'll do them the way, you know, we all would collectively think was a good implementation, and maybe they wouldn't. And I do think that loss of power once it happens was some of hesitation that I think is a little valid. I came to this with the same urgency that I think Senator Rosenbaum expressed in terms of where the public is on this. So I give up on leading with the need to respond to that public message kind of reluctantly in my personal, you know, contribution to the work that's done here. But I also, from what people are saying, can see some value in building some of the building blocks that respond to what the statutes might look like at the time that a constitutional amendment has, as opposed to thinking of it, let's get the constitutional amendment and then we'll work on the underneath. If that starts to make people more comfortable, we don't have to say, and we'll never speak of constitutional amendments again as long as we live, but by working on these things, we help lay some groundwork for this. It just, that's kind of, to me, that's what many of you expressed, and maybe I'm misreading. I will be glad if people, you know, don't want to just leave the table because, you know, we didn't have a successful root out, and we do still have major disagreements, you know, philosophical and otherwise, you know, among the parties here. But absolutely willing to work with you all and to work with Aaron to think about what are some new educational information. You're all people who will have an influence in the building here and out in the community, no matter what. And the more, you know, we learn together, the more informed we've got people speaking about it. I see value in that for the public as well as for the legislature. So I'm kind of, you know, willing to go forward as you are. Nikki's point about representation was important. We have lost two members. I don't think it was because we were failing, you know, abject failures. It was more other things that occurred to them in their lives. But we've lost one non-affiliated voter representative and one of the interest of nonprofit organizations. And in fact, we had hoped to have that spot filled by somebody who may represent some of the new emerging populations that are interested in the electoral side. So I'm very open to, and those are two, I think, that I can point out. I didn't have control over all appointments, obviously. The legislative leadership does the legislators. My commitment was that the party representation that was required by the statute would be chosen by those parties and not by me, you know, doing my favorite IPO guy or my favorite Democrat or my favorite whatever. So I tend to think of those as not, and then we had some specifically assigned organizations. But these are two that I would have the ability to appoint, and at this moment or not down the line would probably Laura and my team will be the one working on, you know, trying to see about some recruiting, and would welcome your recommendations for both people and or paths to look for people. In some ways, we've got the perfect balance, you know, that which was reflected in a completely divided philosophical place. And to the extent that folks may feel like, you know, the biggest, most urgent mission falls to the end of the discussion as opposed to being upfront to it, and that's, you know, not what they signed up for, I'm certainly not going to, you know, be unhappy, you know, with them or about that. That's important, and people concerned later about that. But I feel like we've got a good list from today of things that we could potentially explore. I do appreciate your time, and if there are other things that you think the group should discuss or some back and forth that you want to have. I don't want to cut it off prematurely, but I'm feel pretty good about what we've put on the table and think about future agendas.
So I have a question. It's personal, and it's part of the reason that the party is reluctant on supporting a constitutional amendment right now. And that is, when the campaign finance reform was on the ballot and a portion of it didn't pass and a portion did pass, did anybody do an exit poll to determine why the part that we needed didn't pass?
I can,
is there some research was done?
I can tell you, I believe one of the oppositions to, so I would naturally think that people who are in favor of the statute would have voted for the constitutional amendment if they thought it was necessary. But the one of the campaign points against it was the idea that it wasn't actually necessary, that the statute would be enforced anyways. It turns out that wasn't the case because of the of how the Secretary of State interpreted it later, and then later the State Supreme Court. So that's like a major thing that was part of the public campaign and was influencing people to vote against the constitutional amendment. Many of them thought it just wasn't necessary to get the statute to be enforced.
So what has changed that we think it will pass now?
Well, now we know it is necessary.
Do the voters know it is necessary?
But whether it came from the legislature or from the outside, that would all have to play out as a campaign would. But no, that's very good. And there certainly is a lot of data over the years that voters are more reluctant, slightly more reluctant, maybe not hugely more reluctant around constitutional amendments than statutes. But we could see whether there has been more analysis from Norman.
So, Margie, I can only answer for the League of Women Voters, your question. We did, in fact, oppose Measure 46, and it was in part because it we thought put too much into the Constitution that it tried to restrict what the legislature could do by putting some supermajorities in there. And our philosophy is that the legislature is, in fact, the right place to have complicated conversations about statutes and laws. So a simpler version of the same thing would probably get our attention and probably in the endorsement. But I think polling on the subject is such that people to like 80% feel that contribution limits are, in fact, necessary. And there's a broad bipartisan consensus in that.
Madam Chair, I want to clarify that when I made my comment, what I said was productive. I didn't say good or bad. I said productive. And the reason why I think public financing is interesting is because it's moving forward. It allows us to explore an area that might have I still think what Representative Rayfield is talking about is a quick way for us to make a step forward. But clearly, we're all also trying to avoid unintended consequences. The public will to bring change is general. And our task, if we're to do something, is to do something specific. I watched in Montana the passage of a campaign caps limit put together by folks, myself included, who wanted to see increased grassroots access and increased candidates focused on communication with voters. And the immediate unintended consequence was, because of the caps, candidates tripled the amount of time they had to spend on fundraising, reducing their ability to do voter contact, and absolutely couldn't afford to fund grassroots campaigns. They could no longer afford to hire a field organizer. They had to only raise their budget for TV because that's what their opponent was doing. So when I talk about concerns, is that it's not good or bad. There's things we can figure out, but there looks like some immediate steps, Representative Rayfield's in particular, some of the other things we discussed that we can start moving on when we have this. I wish I had Seth's confidence that the exact outcome of Citizens United will be where it's going to go, but I believe in general elections, and I know Minnesota used to have a governor called Jesse Ventura, so the possibilities of the outcome I'm not as locked in as other people are. But anyway, so that's my point, is if we're going to be together, maybe we can educate ourselves on some areas that we could actually kind of explore and build on.
And I failed to follow up, as I promised Representative Kenemer I do. So that was Brad Martin from the Democratic Party of Oregon. And maybe as we go forward, we can make sure that we identify ourselves. Or maybe we're done. and that's fine, too. So I would like to know if there are folks who feel like my investment is elsewhere, and if you're a party representative, that you find somebody else, or, you know, all of that, so we can get sort of a membership set to go forward. Aaron and I will work together a little bit and perhaps do, at least this time, do a proposed agenda that you all can maybe comment on before we finalize it. I'm not sure. I haven't looked at the calendar. I don't know how many and whatever. Remember that the task force lives through July of 2017, so there's going to be a change of chair at some point down the line, and voters will decide who that is, and then they will have to decide their investment in the process. Appreciate your attention today and attendance, and encourage folks to go back and read our report, and as you gather your list of things that we might want to discuss, you know, keep in mind what we've, you know, what we, the touch points that we looked at before, but we'll take all this into account.
Madam Secretary, do you have any idea when our next meeting might be, and can we?
We didn't do any calendar looking before, so I'm a little embarrassed. And
maybe we could set out a calendar for the whole year.
That's what I would hope that we would do. Yeah. Yes, right.
And to that point, Madam Chairman of the committee, we will do our best to align meetings with interim days for sure in September and then in December, but that's a long period of time in between now and then. So I would anticipate with some hope that we see one in the summer at minimum, one, and then something in between September and December. It's going to be a challenging time with the election and knowing everybody's, you know, responsibilities in the general election, but maybe a post-election before the end of the new year, before the end of the year kind of period. So roughly one in the summer, one in September, one mid to end of November, and one in December. Just kind of begin to think about what that looks like for you. And what
we'll
your calendar looks like, but that's just
we'll
a kind
that
of rough,
quickly, yeah.
Just a rough kind of feedback on that question.
So we should have a report again for the next legislative session that would be set or adopted probably in January.
We are not required to report.
I know we're not
again.
Required, but
I only point that
desirable.
Out, meaning that it provides us some latitude as to when we do make our report and to what form it looks like and to the extent that we have some opportunity for increased access to bills in advance. So we don't have a deadline like we had last time, so we have some more latitude and moving forward toward looking at the 2017 legislative session and looking what February start will look like then.
Maybe the deadline for bill drafting would be one of our possible deadlines.
Absolutely, we have more, yeah. That's precisely the kind of latitude we have to take into account when we report.
But we'll try to get to you quickly on schedule issues. So, Seth.
So I'm a little bit concerned on the discussion about how we can come to consensus on an item, because we've seen yesterday there was a decision by your office that very closely related things that are conditioned upon each other are getting thrown out as not closely related, and so if we were to do anything even slightly creative, the expectation would be that, like, even your office is saying we can't do it.
One of the things that would happen in a situation where we were pulling things together is that we would have legislative council here at the table and have the opportunity to work through what the general consensus is. Now, the legislature, when they're putting something forward, they rely on legislative council to make determinations about closely related, what are appropriate, separate issues that could merge in on the ballot. Department of Justice might have a different view. We could certainly ask them to, you know, come as well, but that would be part of the process that we could work through so that everybody tries to, you know, to formulate it in a way that might not, you know, reach the difference of opinion that our office has based on DOJ advice and my own thinking as well.
Disagree with everyone who thinks that accountability and disclosure is an acquired part of accountability related to the issue?
this isn't the place for that discussion. I mean, the discussion of closely related is an issue of constitutional complaints for initiatives and for referenda is a whole different area of law than campaign finance. Arguments can be made, and obviously any subject matter can be argued to be in one place or the other. But I'm not going to engage in a debate about that decision here. People have, and I hope they have, and if they want it, they can get the opinion of the Department of Justice that I relied on for that decision, and the comment papers that were on many sides that were submitted after the ballot measure was introduced. I'm sure IPO would provide their sense of that. If that's an issue of interest, we'll provide that information.
Didn't get a chance to rebut it either.
I know that there are concerns. IPO has expressed them before, and do understand with that process, the ballot title plus the constitutional compliance with initiative rules compliance, again, that's a different set of issues. If the group wants to look at that, I think it's a little outside. It does certainly apply to every substantive area, but it's kind of outside our scope. But it is also something you could ask legislators to come together and think about. We relied on the laws that stand now in terms of how that process works, and know that there's some significant disagreement about whether there still remains a separate vote issue that has to be resolved. So. Well, thank you all, and please, if indeed you go home and go, I'm not up for, working on the guts of things, I'd rather, spend my energy in another place, please feel free to let me know.
Choose to elect your precinct people by the primary.